Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. This is also Black History Month, and we're going to devote a portion of our hour to the Reverend Martin Luther King, highlighting the last year of his life and revealing little-known facts regarding his murder. That year began with his famous anti-war address at Riverside Church in New York City on April 4, 1967, and ended with his murder in Memphis, Tennessee, exactly 1 year later on April 4, 1968. But first, Marchand, let's examine the latest important developments in the war in Syria. And every time we talk about Syria, Marchand, I feel the need to give essential background information because this information is invariably omitted in the corporate media. As we learned from General Wesley Clark's televised interview with Amy Goodman many years ago, Syria was in the U.S. crosshairs from the beginning of the administration of Bush the Younger. General Clark described a Defense Department memo written shortly after 9/11 in which Syria was among seven countries targeted by the U.S. for overthrow. Others included Iraq, Iran, and Libya. Syria was especially important to take out because it was not only an ally of Iran, its oil and natural gas-rich neighbor, but also because it was allied with Russia, providing Russia with its only port in the Mediterranean. Bush the Younger's efforts against the Syrian government appear to have been limited to funding anti-government political groups. However, the U.S. efforts escalated under President Obama with the appointment of Robert Ford as ambassador to Syria. Ford was a protege of U.S. diplomat John Negroponte, who is widely believed to have been deeply involved in the illegal U.S.-Contra war in Nicaragua in the 1980s, and who presided as ambassador in U.S.-occupied Iraq at the time that the Iraqi opposition devolved into vicious sectarian infighting. Shortly after Ford's appointment, Debka, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, reported that U.S. surrogates, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, were bringing jihadist fighters to camps in the Turkish-Syrian border. It was later reported that these fighters, supervised by the CIA, infiltrated Syria where they began attacks to destabilize the Syrian government. As predicted by U.S. intelligence, the jihadist fighters soon became the dominant element in the U.S.-sponsored uprising, and it evolved into ISIS and captured large swaths of Syria, Iraq, and extended its influence to Egypt and Libya. Meanwhile, Syrian allies Russia and Iran joined the fight with troops and aircraft. These forces have been instrumental in turning the battle against ISIS in favor of the Syrian government. The Syrian war is made even more complicated by Turkey's historic animosity to the Russians and its fear of Kurds. The Kurds, a large stateless ethnic group spanning southern Turkey and northern parts of Syria and Iraq, have provided crucial military support to both the U.S. and Russian and Syrian forces fighting ISIS in northern Syria, particularly around Aleppo. Marchand, recently, Turkey threatened to invade Syria. What would be Turkey's objectives, and how would such an invasion affect the U.S. and Russia?
Turkey's immediate objectives would be to first squash the Kurds, because what the Turks are really afraid of is that Bashar al-Assad and the Russians are empowering the Kurds. Bashar al-Assad seems to have cut more or less a deal with the Kurds, an understanding that we both don't like ISIS, we both don't like the Islamists. You're better off under a Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad than you are with these, you know, ne'er-do-well American and Turkish and Saudi allies. The first step of a Turkish invasion would be to smash the YPG, which are people's defense groups, in the north of Syria. But then to follow up on that and to save their Islamist surrogates, their second goal would be to topple the government of Bashar al-Assad. Now, from the perspective of the Turks, it is all about Russian influence. The Turks are very frightened of having not just a pro-Russian Syrian government, but having Russian troops in Syria. Because from the perspective of Turkey, since the 17th century, the Turks, at that time the Ottoman Empire, were fighting these brutal wars with the Russians, ultimately, in the case of the Turks, to prevent themselves from being surrounded by the Russians, and then from the perspective of the Russians, to prevent the Turks from being used as a jumping-off point into the Slavic nations. So we are seeing an age-old battle between Russia and Turkey being played out. An interesting player in this equation is Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is bringing the Gulf states and many other Arab countries, such as Egypt and Oman, to support the Turkish effort. However, the Saudi motivations and the Gulf motivations are a little different in that for them, it's not so much about being hemmed in by Russia as it is about the Shiites. ISIS was useful because ISIS was wiping out the Shiites, but now that it appears Bashar al-Assad and Russia are winning, Russia is seen as pro-Shiite. So from the Saudi perspective, a Russian victory equals a Shiite victory.
It is such a complicated game, isn't it, Marshawn? Because Saudi Arabia is basically a Wahhabi kingdom. The Wahhabi religion is the backbone of ISIS. So Saudi Arabia has got this bizarre situation where on one hand, they're an ally of the United States. On another hand, they have to placate the Wahhabi forces within their own country in order to stay in power.
Absolutely. And I think in a lot of ways, the Saudi royal family views the Wahhabis and views particularly ISIS as a useful tool. ISIS is exterminating the Shiites, saving Saudi Arabia the trouble, and reducing the potency of the Shiite governments. However, at the end of the day, ISIS is bankrolled by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. So what this means, though, is that Saudi Arabia and their Gulf allies have the ability, at least as they see it, to pull the financial plug on ISIS if or when they so choose. And they know at the end of the day that militarily speaking, they could defeat ISIS in a very, very misguided way. They view ISIS as a useful pliant tool. And much in the same way that the Turks viewed ISIS as useful, because again, ISIS was, for them, it wasn't about being anti-Shia. ISIS was anti-Russian and anti-Kurd. So if ISIS exterminated the Kurds, you know, it was more to the benefit of Turkey. So Turkey also viewed ISIS as a useful tool. Now, from the Turkish perspective, again, it was more practical. Turkey's not bankrolling ISIS, but Turkey has the largest military in NATO. So Turkey could just steamroll over ISIS if it really wants to. And I think at this stage, what we're starting to see is ISIS has outlived its usefulness for the Turks and the Saudis. That's why they're talking about invading, because they realize ISIS is losing. ISIS is going to lose. And moreover, the other Islamist allies of Turkey and Saudi Arabia are losing, because as we can see, the Russian forces and the Syrian Arab army has surrounded Aleppo. They're moving in on Aleppo. They're advancing towards Raqqa, the ISIS capital. So it's very clear that this war feasibly could be over, you know, as the old adage goes, could be over by Christmas. Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev of Russia said rather observantly that if anybody has the power to stop Turkey and prevent this situation from escalating, it's the United States. President Obama has the power to stop Turkey, but President Obama has remained largely silent. And John Kerry's efforts, I think, is that effort to try through more or less peaceful means to prevent Aleppo from falling. But if the worst should come to the worst, let the Turks deal with it. Or alternatively, it is also very, very possible that the Obama administration just does not know what to do. We don't want to tell Turkey no. We don't want to tell the Turks you can't go into Syria and defeat Bashar al-Assad, because that would actually work out really well for us. But on the other hand, we also don't want to acknowledge that if the Turks don't go in, the rebels will lose and will have to surrender Syria to the Russians.
The United States, in its policy in Syria, since it began to foment this armed uprising against the Syrian government, it's created essentially an impossible situation. The most reliable surrogates we were using were Islamists. The Islamists morph into ISIS. We can't tolerate ISIS. So now we want to overthrow the Syrian government. We want to displace Russia. On the other hand, we don't want ISIS in charge. It's really a very bad situation for the U.S.
ISIS was something that was going to eventually be defeated, but what we were hoping in a lot of ways was that ISIS again would be a contributing factor to weakening the Syrian government. But I don't think in a lot of ways we really thought of what we're going to do after Bashar al-Assad falls. But now we really have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that without a direct military intervention, our only choices are Bashar al-Assad or ISIS. Since our so-called rebels have failed, there really is no alternative to Bashar al-Assad other than an invasion where we try to overthrow him and maybe divvy up the country. But the fact is, though, is that the Russians are not going to let him fall. And in fact, Medvedev even said openly that any invasion of Syria will result in World War III. Turkey is a member of NATO. If the Russians and the Turks begin shooting at each other again, what's invariably going to happen? All Turkey has to do is enact Article 5 of the NATO treaty, and now we're dragged into this conflict. Yes, if the Turks are serious about this, it can result in a much, much wider conflict.
Which, of course, is not in the interest of the United States. So perhaps the United States should concede that its efforts to overthrow the Syrian government have failed, and that in order to stabilize the situation, we should reconcile ourselves to the idea that Syria will remain a Soviet ally, that if we reach an accommodation with the Russians, ISIS can quickly be defeated and stability restored to the country. I mean, would that be a reasonable strategy to accept?
We can sit down with the Russians and we can say, listen, we're going to divvy up the Middle East. Iran is yours. Syria is yours. Lebanon is yours. However, we will have influence in Egypt. We will have influence in Saudi. We will have influence in Iraq. And that's how you divvy things. I mean, that's how these rivals in the turn of the century, in the, you know, the 19th century, who nominally hated each other, how they established a sort of global balance was because they agreed to divvy up. Africa was a perfect example. And is it entirely fair to the people who have to live under this divvied up system? Probably not, but it's certainly a heck of a lot better than us bludgeoning each other to death over it. The most pragmatic thing would be to create spheres of influence, the same as we had during the Cold War, or the same as had occurred during the colonial era of the 19th century, when the French and the British and the Germans and the Russians all developed spheres of influence over, and even the United States, over parts of Asia, over Africa, and even the Middle East. So, you know, this is something that has happened before. We can reach this kind of balance. The problem is we are trying to coerce and dictate terms. Probably more importantly, we are trying to dictate terms from a position of weakness. The Russians know this. The Russians know. There was a study done by, I believe it was Newsweek, which said that the Russians could take and capture all of the Baltic republics in 3 days. Now, why can they do this in 3 days? Is because our army, our navy, our air force, our Marine Corps has been thoroughly gutted and hollowed out. And the thing is, the Russians know this. We still haven't gotten this concept. You cannot dictate terms to somebody that you are in a weaker position to.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and we've been updating you on the war in Syria. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1, and to download a copy of the show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. Marshawn, I'd like to take a look at the war in Ukraine. And again, I'd like to start with a little bit of background. Although the Ukraine was once a republic within the Soviet Union, it became an independent country following the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War. Since the early 1990s, the United States and its allies have successfully pursued a strategy of incorporating former Soviet republics and Soviet allies into NATO, the Western Military Alliance. If the Ukraine is added to NATO, Russia would be virtually encircled. The current crisis in the Ukraine began in early 2014 when the elected pro-Russian government of the Ukraine was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup and replaced with a pro-U.S. government amenable to joining NATO. Soon thereafter, the Russian ethnic minority in eastern Ukraine revolted, setting off a bloody civil war which so far has claimed thousands of lives, many of them civilians. The U.S. supports the government in Kiev with funds and trainers, while Russia has provided military support to the separatists. 1 year ago, the Russians brokered a ceasefire between the central Ukraine government in Kiev and the ethnic Russian separatists, but the ceasefire has proved tenuous. Marshawn, what's the current situation on the ground in the Ukraine?
Well, there have been skirmishes that have been reported in Reuters and Agence France-Presse, and it's not getting covered, of course, in the Russian media. And actually, it's being glossed over in the U.S. media, too. So, but through the major international news outlets, such as Reuters and Agence France-Presse and the Associated Press, there have been reports of sporadic fighting About a week ago, the Ukrainians lost several dozen soldiers were killed in skirmishes with the Russians. Additionally, it has been reported that Russian, or they say separatists, but the Russians more or less, have moved forward their heavy artillery that they had withdrawn from the border as part of the ceasefire. Now, part of this arguably could be because President Petro Poroshenko of Ukraine had announced for his New Year's address, he announced that by the end of this year, Ukraine will be united, which is not so much a veiled threat towards the separatists and towards the Russians. So I think it's natural that this is the situation on the ground has begun to escalate. And certainly we do have to see that as the weather gets warmer, I actually have on my phone, it's programmed to monitor several weather in several regions of the world. And one of those I keep an eye on is Eastern Ukraine, because as the weather gets warmer, the ability for troops and tanks to maneuver increases, and ergo the risk of violence increases.
What we're seeing played out is essentially a proxy war between the United States and Russia, with the Ukrainian people caught in the middle.
Absolutely, just the same as Syria is a proxy war between us, NATO, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and the Russians and Iran. Ukraine is a proxy war between Russia and NATO. One of the problems, though, that we can see from this situation is that if, as we were talking about the Turks before, were to, let's say, go into Syria and start shooting at Russians, and Russians shoot at them, and the situation escalates, and NATO were to be drawn in, Russia right now is in a position where if it wanted to sweep into the Baltic states, it could. If it wanted to march on Kiev, it could. The Ukrainian army is not capable of holding its own. This has given Russia an excuse to have forward units in Eastern Europe. And so we are seeing a situation that's becoming more increasingly dangerous, because it's not only affected by what's going on in Ukraine, but it's affected by the other proxy conflicts we're fighting with the Russians in the Middle East.
How important is the Ukraine to U.S. national security?
George Bush Jr. got a lot of grief for being a little dopey, but you know what? He worked well with Putin. Our relations with Russia had never been better than they were under George Bush Jr. And certainly one of the reasons for that was because he respected spheres of influence. President Bush, when there was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and the Ukrainians were electing a pro-Western leader, George Bush had the understanding with Putin that we're not going to intervene. We're not going to step in and try to dictate terms in Ukraine. Ukraine's in your sphere of influence. Step into NATO and you'll get your nose bloodied, but we will not interfere in the Russian sphere of influence. That's also why under George Bush Jr., there was no major push to bring Georgia into NATO either. And that's one of the things that we see with the Obama administration, is this major push to bring Georgia into NATO, bring Ukraine into NATO, bring all of these former Soviet republics into NATO, which is, again, bound to antagonize the Russians. Because we have to remember, the concept of a buffer is essential to the Russian psyche. The reason why Stalin, who, by the way, was a Georgian, but he was ruler of Russia, the reason why he sees so much of Eastern Europe at the end of World War II is because he said that he would guarantee there would never be another German invasion of Russia or another Western invasion of Russia. And this is crucial because everything for Russia has been about what is on its borders. Russia, during the Great Game, when countries were driving for colonies in Africa, was interested more in fighting the Turks than they were in fighting wars in South Africa. And the reason was because Russia's view of the world is in concentric circles emanating from the Kremlin at the center. The further away you are from that center, relatively speaking, the less important you are.
If I can suggest a parallel, putting the Ukraine into NATO would be comparable to Russia having gotten Mexico to join the Warsaw Pact.
Precisely, exactly. Bringing Ukraine into NATO, bringing NATO troops up to the Russian doorstep would be like the Red Army being in Juarez.
There seemed to be a pattern of, I would say, pretty serious mistakes here. The invasion of Iraq, which is becoming, that invasion is now coming under a lot of criticism during the Republican debates, which is quite a change. And of course, the overthrow of the Libyan government, which we brought about, just also turned out to be a complete disaster, creating a non-functioning state there. So it seems that it's a good time for a fundamental reevaluation of American foreign policy. And perhaps this presidential year will facilitate such a discussion. Now, Marcia, when we talk about the national security interests of the United States, whether it's Syria or the Ukraine, we need to also look at China and the Pacific. Very interesting report recently was that China has deployed surface-to-air missiles in the South China Sea at a place called Woody Island. These missiles have a range of 125 miles and can knock down ballistic missiles and aircraft. A Woody Island lies in waters also claimed by Vietnam and Taiwan and is located about 250 miles north of China's new artificial islands in the Spratlys. The Woody Island missiles not only strengthen China's presence in the South China Sea, but also protect its important new naval bases for surface vessels and submarines at Sanya and the island province of Hainan. Now, the United States for some time now has been calling on China to pull back on its expansion of the South China Sea. President Obama recently asserted at the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations that the United States will insist on maintaining freedom of navigation in the international waters of the South China Sea. Are we headed towards a collision with China in the South China Sea and perhaps the whole Pacific?
I think in a lot of ways we are, especially in light of China's aggressive nature. There is almost a reluctance to believe we could actually either be attacked by China or that the Chinese would be willing to fight us. Again, history repeats itself. One of the reasons why we were so surprised when the Japanese decided to attack Pearl Harbor was because we believe there's no way they would be that stupid. We're paying for their oil. We're making sure that they have rubber and everything for their war machine in China. There's no way the Japanese would be stupid enough to attack us. And it's the same sort of loony logic that you hear with regards to China. Oh, the Chinese, we owe the Chinese so much money, there's no way they'd ever go to war with us. Well, there is a point when, you know, you can't bank on the fact that the bank will always view you as, you know, as a useful debtor. After a while of not paying debt, the bank might figure another way to get its own back. And probably more to the liking, unlike a bank, this is more like dealing with a mob. Eventually, they're going to want to get their own. And certainly what the Chinese are interested in, and one of the reasons why they're building these naval bases, is to take control of the natural resources, the oil and natural gas, in the South China Sea and in the Pacific. And it may come to that point where either they decide to provoke the Japanese or they decide to provoke the South Koreans, which is something we've been seeing. The Japanese and the Chinese have been very much heading towards a collision course, especially with the seizure of those Japanese islands, sovereign Japanese territory. We bemoan the seizure of Crimea by the Russians, but yet we said nothing about the seizure of Japanese islands by the Chinese. It runs the same risk, the same potential of sparking a larger conflict. So it is entirely possible, but we've been ignoring the threat that China poses, this very aggressive stance, this outward expansionism. And certainly they may decide, you know, that they want more, that they need more, you know, or that maybe even that a war might be beneficial.
Marshawn, I'm just wondering if you contrast the situation with our relationship with Russia. I can visualize how we could reach an accommodation with the Russians, acknowledging their need to have at least neutral countries on their borders and develop a much more friendly relation with the Russians, promoting trade and whatnot, and eventually having pretty good stability in Europe and even the Mideast. But when it comes to China and the Pacific, I'm trying to visualize how this situation could be stabilized because we have our alliance with Japan since World War II. We have our alliance with South Korea, with North Korea essentially and a very bellicose Chinese surrogate next door. We have our neighbor, our allies in, say, the Philippines who are very vulnerable. How is the situation going to stabilize with China continually expanding?
Well, and that's the issue fundamentally. When it comes to somebody like Russia, there's you know what they want. There's a predictable quality to it because this has occurred time and time again throughout Russian history. They want, as you said, at least neutral countries, if not, you know, pliant nation states on their border. But if we're willing to create spheres of influence, there can be a balance created because we have reached this with the Russians. The British were able to reach this with the Russians. On the other hand, though, with China, it's a lot more unpredictable, especially because China has never in its history been as outwardly expansionist as it is now. And this creates a dangerous quality because it is exceptionally unpredictable. The Chinese have never really ventured this far into whether it's territory controlled by U.S. allies or just other nations in general. So this is a very unpredictable quality that we're seeing within the Chinese. The other problem that we face when it comes to the Chinese is, again, they are in a position of strength. The Philippines, South Korea, Japan do not pose any significant military opposition to China. China is speaking from a position of strength. They are in a position to dictate terms. But again, if they try to dictate terms and we decide that we don't want to cede the Pacific to them, that's where you run the risk of a conflict. Fundamentally, the most important thing would be to bring the Russians into our camp, because that'd be the only way you'd truly be able to hem in the Chinese. The Chinese and the Russians have naturally been antagonistic to each other. Even during the Cold War, the Red Army and the People's Liberation Army had actually fought skirmishes. So the Chinese and the Russians are not natural allies. And again, also going into since the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. Yes, it's a dictatorship, but it's still much more akin to the West than China is. China is an atheistic communist state which believes fundamentally in the superiority of the Han Chinese people. They suppress all other ethnicities in China, to include Cantonese, Tibetans, Uyghurs, and certainly anyone who's not Han. This really poses a complication when it comes to the Chinese-Russian relationship, unless, of course, we try to antagonize both of them, in which case we bring them together as allies of convenience.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the situation in the Ukraine. We've also been talking about Chinese expansion in the South China Sea and what it portends for U.S. power in the Pacific. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to one. To download a copy of the show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. This is Black History Month, and we're going to devote the rest of the In Context War Report show to Reverend Martin Luther King, who in the last year of his life turned his attention to the anti-war movement. What follows is my interview with attorney and author William Pepper. Reverend King contacted Mr. Pepper after King read Pepper's January 1967 photo essay in Rampart magazine showing the toll of U.S. napalm attacks on children in the Vietnam War. They became friends, and Pepper's anti-war views helped influence Reverend King's April 4, 1967 Riverside Church address, where Dr. King expanded his civil rights campaign to include the anti-war movement. Following King's murder in Memphis, Tennessee, 1 year later, the King family came to believe that the official story attributing the murder to James Ray was false, and they sought Mr. Pepper's legal help to uncover the truth. In the interview, William Pepper describes the events leading up to the murder of Reverend King and the true facts of the crime as found by the jury in a trial in Tennessee in 1999. Amazingly, these startling facts about the King murder are still generally unknown to the American public.
Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Pepper.
You're welcome.
Can you tell us when and where Martin Luther King was murdered?
Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on the 4th of April, 1968, at approximately 1 minute past six.
And why was he in Memphis, Tennessee?
He was in Memphis, Tennessee, and to organize a march on behalf of the striking garbage workers. They had been on strike for a period of months, and it had polarized the Memphis community. Dr. King led a march on the 28th of March, which broke up into turbulence and violence, and he had to be rushed from the scene. Later, we learned that march was broken up by provocateurs who came from outside of Memphis, particularly from Chicago and St. Louis.
Now, while many Americans think of Martin Luther King principally as a civil rights leader, in the year before his death, he started to move into other areas. Can you talk about that?
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and I came to know him when I came back from Vietnam. I'd been a journalist in Vietnam. And when I came back, I wrote one piece in particular that caught his attention. It had to do with, or Ramparts magazine, and it had to do with the effect of the war on the civilian population of Vietnam, most of whom were either under 15 years of age or elderly, and they were, of course, being slaughtered. That struck, some of my photographs struck him, and so he asked to meet with me, and I worked with him then the last year of his life, and began pretty conclusively to turn him and see him turn into more than a civil rights leader, and that had been the direction he'd been heading in anyway, but he now became a committed human rights advocate and an anti-war campaigner.
He made a famous speech at Riverside Church just a year before the assassination.
Yeah, 1 year to the day,
in which in which he declared his opposition to the war. He was also involved in a poor people's campaign that was going to have a demonstration in Washington that summer.
Yes, he was leaving Memphis, actually, to head into Mississippi and begin the mobilization of marchers into Washington, not for the purpose of holding a demonstration and marching, but for the purpose of living in an encampment inside Washington, the shadow of the Washington Memorial. So he was going to bring many, many thousands of people there for the purpose of taking up residence in the nation's capital and going up and visiting their Congress, the people, on a daily basis, in an effort to try to press them to put back into the budget funds that had been taken out and were needed for social programs, but had been denied because of the war.
And there was also some talk that he might run for president in 68?
Yes, there was a very distinct movement, and that's really what became a major part of my activity. He asked me to head up a National Conference for New Politics, which was an umbrella organization of all the anti-war and peace activist movements throughout the country, including many sort of disenchanted Democrats, members of the Democratic Party, who wanted to see this war end. And the idea was to form a ticket of Martin King and Dr. Benjamin Spock as a third party alternative and on an anti-war platform.
You note that in 1979, the House Select Committee on Assassinations found that the FBI had targeted Martin Luther King since the early 60s. Why was the FBI after Dr. King?
Hoover took a strong personal dislike to Dr. King, and of course, Hoover was looking for every opportunity he could to tie the civil rights movement and Martin King to communist influence in the Communist Party. This, of course, was an effort to divert, and successfully did for many years, divert attention away from Hoover's alliance with organized crime and his working relationship effectively with organized crime in the United States by being able to deny its existence, which he did for many, many years. And he targeted King and other civil rights leaders.
These activities included things like burglaries and wiretaps and infiltration of
the staff. The whole Quantelpro operation.
You mentioned that they even had an informant in his executive staff.
Yes, they had an informant who was handled by an agent out of the Atlanta field office.
Now, subsequent to the shooting of Dr. King on April 4th, who was arrested for the murder?
Well, James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport in London and charged with the assassination. He had been well and duly set up, although none of us realized it at the time, and indeed, I didn't realize it for 9 years. It took me 9 years. 9 years later, when Abernathy asked me to go interrogate Ray, that we began to really look at the serious possibility that the man was innocent.
How did he supposedly do the crime? Where was he shooting from?
Well, supposedly he committed the crime from a bathroom window, a rooming house that backed onto Mulberry Street and the Lorraine Motel. And supposedly, allegedly, he had rented a room and he just waited for Dr. King to appear. And then he shot him and fled down the stairway and out the front door, where he went a few feet south on Main Street, dropped the bundle in the doorway of an amusement parlor and record shop, and then got into a Mustang and drove away. Now, that was the story that of the actual killing that the government put forward.
And he did plead guilty subsequently.
He was coerced by his second lawyer, Percy Forman, who had promised him a trial, but at the end of the last minute, coerced him into pleading, into copping a plea, saying they were going to fry him. The media had already convicted him, that his family would be harassed forever. But the main reason, James told me, that he finally decided just to plea was Forman said, look, my health is not good, and I can't give you your best defense. So just take this plea and then hire another lawyer, set it aside, and you'll be much better off.
Did Ray recant his plea?
Oh, sure. He always, I mean, he never actually said that he did it. He accepted legal responsibility in a series of check stipulations. And James had 3 days after the sentencing hearing, he moved to set aside his guilty plea and to seek a trial.
Although the government claimed that Ray had committed the murder by shooting from a bathroom in a rooming house, several witnesses, you point out, appeared to have seen gunfire coming from a bushy area instead.
Yeah, that's right. The area behind the rooming house, which is now, by the way, a museum, but the area behind that rooming house was overgrown with bushes and brush and massive amount of undergrowth there. And that's where the sniper actually lay in wait. And yes, he was seen by a number of people who independently reported seeing.
In addition, during the course of your representation, a judge ruled that the gun, the rifle that he allegedly used, had not been sighted?
Yeah, it had not been sighted in, and it was off both to the left and too low, so it could not have been used in that murder. And in addition to that, of course, the state could not match any test fires from that rifle to the death slug.
Now, the rooming house was above a grill owned by a man named Lloyd Jowers. And in 1993, Mr. Jowers made a request for immunity to the Tennessee Attorney General. Can you talk about what he admitted to doing?
Yeah, Jowers initially just started off by admitting that he had been involved in the conspiracy to kill Dr. King, and he asked for immunity. He wasn't a good citizen. I mean, it's not something he did voluntarily of the goodness of his heart. We had a number of witnesses, independent witnesses, who tied Lloyd Jowers to this killing. But he didn't know that he was going to not be indicted, and so he thought he'd asked his lawyer to get immunity for him.
And what was his involvement with respect to the rifle, with respect to the funds that may have been used for the assassination?
Well, Jowers received $100,000 in a delivery box, in a vegetable delivery box, which was routed to him by Frank Liberto, who was a lieutenant in the Carlos Marcello organization. He received that money in his grill, called Jim's Grill. His role was to accept and hold on to the murder weapon for a brief period of time, and then it was to basically be out in the back Bush's area, and to take the weapon from the shooter, which he did. And as he burst into the back of the kitchen with a still smoking rifle, there was Betty Spates, who had been his mistress for a number of years, who had come looking for him, and she saw him rush by her holding this gun, break it down, and wrap it into a towel. But she heard that only moments after she had heard the rifle shot. She was standing inside the kitchen. She heard the rifle.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. You're listening to an interview with attorney and author William Pepper, in which he describes a trial in which he represented the King family in uncovering the true circumstances regarding the murder of Reverend Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, on April the 4th, 1968. The In Context War Report is broadcast in the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. To download a copy of this show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com.
Now, he also made admissions to Dexter King and Andrew Young, not just about the money and the rifle, but about planning sessions that occurred in Jim's Grill involving Memphis Police Department personnel. Can you talk about that?
there were planning sessions in the grill. It involved a number of police officers in the Memphis Police Department, and Jowers admitted that they took place. So he was fully involved in this operation.
The Memphis Police Department failed to undertake certain security measures you mentioned when Dr. King came to Memphis on April 4th, including depriving him of his usual security guard of black detectives?
Yes, there was usually a group of detectives, poor black detectives, who had always watched out for Dr. King when he came to Memphis. And in this instance, they were not formed.
You also mentioned that the emergency tactical police units were pulled back from the Lorraine Motel, and that, curiously, two black firemen assigned to a firehouse overlooking the Lorraine were told not to report.
Yeah, there were the TAC-10 unit that had been stationed at the Lorraine was pulled back to the fire station, to the firehouse, which is on the corner of Mulberry and stretches up to South Main Street. They were pulled back there out of the area, the immediate area. The two black firemen were instructed not to show up that day. They were removed from duty.
And it's not clear why Dr. King was assigned a room with a balcony.
His room was supposed to be down below in an alcove area. They switched his room virtually at the last minute and put him up in room 306, which was the balcony room overlooking the swimming pool, which, of course, was not in use. But he was in an ideally exposed position for the assassination.
Now, who was Frank Liberto, the man who gave Jowers the $100,000?
Frank Liberto, who arranged the funds, did not himself give them to him. He had them by a delivery person. Frank Liberto ran a food wholesale warehouse outside of downtown Memphis, and he was Marcello's man in Memphis. Very close connections with the police department because they were very much involved in illegal gambling and prostitution and drug running, the usual mob activities, and they needed protection, which they got. And Liberto was the guy who was assigned to carry out a lot of the work on the ground in terms of organizing the assassination.
Now, a man named John McFerrin gave evidence about a phone call that he heard just before the assassination, to be on April 4th, around 4:45 or 5 o'clock. Can you talk about what Mr. McFerrin says he heard?
He owned a small grocery store and gas station up in Somerville, about an hour from Memphis, and he would shop once a week at Liberto's warehouse and pick up his wholesale products. And he was in there on the day of the assassination, on April 4th in the afternoon, about an hour and a half before the killing. At one point when he was in the store, he heard Liberto on the telephone screaming into the telephone, "Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes out on the balcony, and don't bring your ass around here. Go down to New Orleans and get the rest of your money from my brother."
Tell me about a man named Raul and what involvement he had.
Raul was James's handler. James had always said that he had a handler, and his name was Raul. And he'd been treated as some sort of fanciful figure, but we've pretty much established who he was, and the fact is that he did handle. He was James's handler. He did meet him in a bar up in Montreal as James was trying to leave the country. Remember, James was an escaped convict, and he was on the run trying to leave the country. And this guy, there are certain people had been helping him and steering him toward the Canadian docks in Montreal, and he was in this bar, and that's where this fellow Raul effectively picked him up, made contact with him, offered him a job, offered to buy him a car, and wanted to keep him on a string for making certain deliveries for him and running errands, at the end of which he promised him he would get travel documents for him.
Did Raul have anything to do with getting a rifle to the grill?
Yeah, I mean, Raul, of course, designated the rifle that James was to buy, and when James bought the wrong rifle, Raul sent him back. This was in Birmingham to buy a .30-06, which he didn't buy the first time. So, and then Raul met him the night before the killing. He met him at the New Rebel Motel just outside of Memphis and took the rifle away from James. That was the last James saw of the rifle. The rifle, that rifle was the throwdown gun that was found in Knipe's doorway.
I see, and another gun was actually used for the assassination.
Oh, yes. No, yeah, that was just a throwdown gun.
Now Raul connects to Carlos Marcello through a gun-running operation that also connects the U.S. military. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it was an interesting, almost convoluted connection. Around this time, there were a number of military bases and forts that were being looted of weapons, of armaments. And they were being often driven into Marcello's place on the water and put on a flatboat, shipped around into Houston, unloaded in Houston, repackaged by a team there. And Raul was part of that team, repackaged by a team there. In fact, this Raul led the team. And then they were being sold into Latin and South America. Two of the people who drove, two of the grunts, soldiers who drove the truck with weapons in, were a part of the sniper unit that was really coincidental. The sniper unit that was in Memphis as a backup unit.
Well, now could you talk about the 902nd Military Intelligence Group and in general the U.S. military domestic spy operations that they were involved in the years preceding the assassination?
Well, I think the military has been far more active and involved in domestic espionage and surveillance on American citizens than has ever been revealed. When Ramsey Clark would not sign an authorization for wiretapping on Dr. King and his residence and his church, and so forth, Hoover then went to his buddies in military intelligence under Bill Yarborough, with the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, and they had the military involved in the surveillance of Dr. King. It was a very extensive operation. The Deuce was right in the middle of all of it.
You mentioned that the 902nd was deployed in small units throughout 67 and 68, and that they carried mug books of black leaders.
Yeah, that's what I was told, that they had small units, often sniper units, and they carried mug books of community leaders who were deemed hostile and to be neutralized in one way or another.
Now some of your information about the 902nd and the military involvement of the events of April the 4th comes from a man named Warren?
Those are pseudonyms. Warren and Murphy are pseudonyms. I try to protect people who are still alive, and certainly people who tried to provide us with information and help us. They're out of the country, and they provided information. They were members of the sniper unit. They provided information through Steve Tompkins, the same journalist who became aware of their presence in Memphis.
Now, you say that Warren was a member of something called Alpha 184 Team. Can you talk about the activities of the team on April 4th?
It was an eight-man sniper unit that left Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and drove, left at about 5:30 in the morning and drove into Memphis. And various members of the unit took up their appointed positions. And their task was, so they thought, was to take out Andrew Young and Martin King. And Andrew Young was a bit of a surprise, but they had two sniper units, two sniper teams, and one of them, the one on top of the railroad building, was to take out Andrew Young. And that, they thought, was their job. And they were in position and ready to go. And then what happened was the sniper was a civilian sniper. And they were the backup, in my view, to that civilian sniper. The civilian sniper fired from the bushes and accomplished the task. And so they were not needed. They were told to disengage and withdraw.
Now, the King family in 97 came to support James Ray's legal maneuverings for a trial. What was the result of that?
There were two trials, that one can say, connected with this whole thing. One back in 93, which related to evidence that we had at the time, and it was actually a television trial, but it was unscripted, and it was bitterly fought with an independent jury and a former federal judge presiding. And that took that, with the minimum of evidence we had at that time, it took that jury 7.5 hours to find James not guilty, which was a shock to Hickman Ewing, in particular, who was the prosecutor, and had former U.S. attorney in Memphis, and former, later to be a Ken Starr prosecutor against Bill Clinton. So that was one then, and that, by the way, opened the floodgates to a lot of information that we didn't have. Okay, the second trial, the one to which you're referring, was the civil trial, which was an actual civil trial.
So you chose a civil route then?
It was the civil route whereby the King family would sue Lloyd Jowers and others, including agents of the United States and agents of the state of Tennessee and city of Memphis, for conspiracy to kill Martin King. Jowers was the key defendant in that trial.
Did they seek damages, monetary?
No, they only thought, well, they did, but only to the extent that, it was required to pay the burial costs.
And that trial,
the equivalent of the burial cost.
And that trial took place in 1999 in Memphis?
Yeah, it took place in 1999 in Memphis, and it lasted for 30 days. It had 70 witnesses. Probably never before in history has an assassination been so well documented and detailed under oath.
And what was the jury's verdict?
The jury found for the King family that a conspiracy existed and took them 59 minutes. And they only attributed 30% of the responsibility to Lloyd Jowers, and the rest they attributed to the government.
So they determined that Lloyd Jowers participated in the conspiracy, but that others, including government agencies, also participated.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was the media's reaction to the verdict?
Silence. The media's reaction to most things has been silence. There was one article in the New York Times, and then it went away. The media stayed in the hallway through most of the trial, not hearing the evidence. When Mrs. King testified, or Andrew Young, or Dexter, they came in, took note of that testimony. But when the real hard evidence was being presented, they were, for the most part, not capable, not willing to report it. So the American people, most American people don't even know the trial took place.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. What you just heard was my 2008 interview with William Pepper, author of The Execution of Martin Luther King. Mr. Pepper, who was an attorney, represented James Earl Ray in Mr. Ray's unsuccessful effort to withdraw his guilty plea in the King murder and obtain a trial. Mr. Pepper subsequently represented Martin Luther King's family in a civil wrongful death action against those believed to be responsible for Reverend King's murder. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. To download a copy of the show, please visit our website, incontextreport.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.